Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Springtime in Iraq, shock and awe, are over. For some, democracy is on the horizon. It is May of 2003.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
In fact, that was only the beginning of a brutal war that nearly tore Iraq apart. But 7 years later, looking to this week's Iraqi elections, we ask whether that declaration of victory might finally be coming true. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, March 1st. I'm Lynn Scherr in for Celeste Headlee. Morning, John.
Good morning, Lynn. And let's get to the top stories we're following this morning. And aftershocks, more than 100 in all since Saturday's massive 8.8 earthquake. They're still rattling the nation of Chile. President Michelle Bachelet says the death toll stands at over 700 and it's likely to rise. The quake was seventh strongest ever on record and 500 times more powerful than the one in Haiti. Strong building codes are being credited with preventing greater devastation. Earlier this morning, we spoke with Charlotte Mountford, who is a writer in Santiago. She told us the sound of the quake was not what she expected.
The earthquake itself was silent, and that was what was so eerie. I expected a roar. I expected a rumble. It was just silent, rocking earth.
Earlier, we also spoke with Paul Simons, the U.S. ambassador to Chile, who described some of the challenges getting aid in and out of the hard-hit southern regions.
Some of the bridges are out. Some of the roads have faults in them, and they're having to make detours, make pontoons.
You can hear the entire interview with Ambassador Simons on our website, thetakeaway.org.
Meanwhile, it's election week in Iraq. After a two-month delay and a blacklist banning more than 500 candidates, Iraqis will go to the polls on Sunday to choose the new parliament in the country's first election in 5 years. For more, BBC reporter in Baghdad Gabriel Gatehouse joined us earlier. I asked him if this election represents the mission that the coalition was trying to accomplish.
I think they're very much hoping that it will be, but I think it depends on two things. The first is security, and while it's better in Iraq than it was a few years ago, this is still a very violent place. Several hundred people are dying every month as a result of violent incidents. So one question will be, will security improve after this election? Will that allow the American troops to withdraw, leaving behind a more or less stable country? The other question is, what kind of government will Iraq have after this election? Because while the official line coming from diplomats here is that they're happy to see any democratic election, if they see American influence dwindling as they withdraw and Iranian influence on the eastern flank growing, then I think some will question whether that is indeed mission accomplished.
More from that interview with Gabriel Gatehouse in just a moment.
Back home, the White House is calling for a simple up or down vote on the health care reform bill. That means bypassing the Republican minority in the Senate in a process called reconciliation. There are reports President Obama may endorse the move in the next few days. Also this morning, the president is offering $900 million in grants to states and school districts to turn around low-performing schools. To get a share of the cash, schools will have to take drastic actions, such as replacing principals, reopening schools as charter schools, or closing them down altogether.
And on the final day of the Winter Olympics, Canada upheld its, okay, national honor with an overtime victory over the U.S. in the gold medal hockey game. That made for a festive atmosphere at last night's closing ceremonies. Overall, the U.S. won 37 medals, the most of any country in any Winter Games. On the markets, new economic numbers out last hour show personal spending jumped by a larger amount than expected in January, but America's incomes barely budged. Wall Street futures are up. The Dow gets underway this hour at 10,325. The S&P opens at 1,104. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,238.
So what does Conan think about Leno back on The Tonight Show? We'll talk about that later on in the hour. And our minds are with the people of Chile this morning. Might have you thinking, when tragedy and disaster strikes, what perspectives come into focus? Tell us your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. Back to Iraq in just a moment.
I'm Lynn Scherr, sitting in for Celeste Headlee. It is now officially election week in Iraq. After a two-month delay and a blacklist banning more than 500 candidates, Sunday is the day to choose the new parliament, Iraq's first election since 2005. But far more is at stake than its 325 seats. The real issue is democracy. How smoothly will the elections go, and what will be the effect on the more than 100,000 U.S. troops who are serving there right now? To get more on this, we spoke with Laith Kuba, an Iraqi who was at one time involved in politics there and is now with the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, D.C. We also spoke with Gabriel Gatehouse, the BBC correspondent in Baghdad. I asked Gabriel about safety in Iraq and whether it would impact the elections.
I think that's very hard to tell. Certainly there's a lot of apprehension. We've seen a few, over the past few months, a number of very high-profile attacks in Baghdad, targeting government infrastructure, ministry buildings, and large hotels. And I think the message that people here have got from that is that these bombers, whoever they are, whether they're Baathists, which is the contention of the Iraqi government, or Al-Qaeda, which seems to be more what the U.S. military seems to suspect, that they can still strike. They still can get through these many, many hundreds and thousands of checkpoints that are across this country. Now, I've been speaking to the man in charge of Baghdad Operations Command. That's the body overall in charge of security. They say they're going to have around 200,000 security force personnel on duty in the capital alone. All these security forces to such an extent that security forces are going to be voting before Election Day itself because they're going to be busy on the day of the vote. Now, they're hoping that will keep the country safe, but I think there is a lot of apprehension as we approach Sunday.
And just outline the issues for us, Gabriel. This is about 325 seats in Parliament. It's about who is re-elected, who is elected president or re-elected prime minister or not re-elected. The issues, is this purely about the individuals? Is this about Sunni versus Shia or what?
I think there's an element of that. I mean, the coalitions present a dizzying picture of shifting alliances at the moment. And I think even once the vote is counted, it's going to be hard to tell what kind of a government will eventually end up with. I think there is a sectarian element here. About a year ago, it looked like the Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, who's running for re-election, was going onto a more secular line of campaigning. He turned his back on some of his former Shiite colleagues. But as Election Day has approached, we've seen that sectarian rhetoric creeping back in. We had this whole row over a blacklist of candidates that you mentioned earlier who were banned from standing due to alleged links with Saddam Hussein's now outlawed Ba'ath Party. Now, although there were candidates from across the sectarian divide on that list, Sunnis have felt more targeted by it than Shiites. So, and then what we saw just a few days ago, Nouri al-Maliki announcing a reinstatement of several thousand former army officers from Saddam's army. This is another very sore point amongst Shiites. People wondering whether this was perhaps a political move trying to mitigate the bad press that he'd got amongst the Sunni community due to that blacklist. It's hard to tell how this is going to play out on Election Day itself amongst voters. I mean, I've been speaking to one of these former officers, a man called Muhammad Ali. He was a lieutenant in Saddam Hussein's army until 2003 when the invasion came in and the army was disbanded. He lost his job, just one of many who did. And I spoke to him just as he was going to re-register, and I asked him how he felt about being reintegrated into the armed forces.
I'm very happy to join the army again because, you know, this is our country and it's our job to, you know, defend it.
Can I ask you, were you, when you were an officer in Saddam's army, were you a member of the Ba'ath Party?
Under Saddam Hussein, the Iraqis were not allowed to be officers unless they joined the Ba'ath Party.
You had to be a member of the Ba'ath Party.
Yeah. Many, many Iraqis are Ba'ath Party members, and they should not be responsible of all the mistakes committed in the past. All the Iraqis should take part in building this country, working together to bring prosperity to this country.
Laith Kuba, listening now to Gabriel's interview with this Ba'athist who's been reinstated. First of all, Ba'athists were outlawed. Why are they coming back, number one? And number two, what is the effect of this and the election on U.S. troops and on the scheduled withdrawal?
Well, the key idea is after 7 years, a lot of Iraqis are saying, okay, Saddam was bad, and this is something we did not want to have. But what did we get in the last 7 years? And the most important thing Iraqis are missing is the presence of a strong state. They do want state institutions, services. They do want a process by which corruption is really kept at check and security is delivered in the streets. This they have not seen. I think people associate a strong state with the Ba'athist. Nobody wants the bad side of the Ba'athist, but I think they are saying, well, at least those guys knew how to run a state. And I think this is what is not spoken amongst Iraqi politicians. A lot of them want to shift the attention towards Saddam's terror, and I think others want to shift the attention towards what are you getting at the end of the day.
And so if the Ba'athists do come back in any numbers, what will the effect be on the U.S. troops? And there are 100,000 troops there now, and on the scheduled withdrawal?
Well, number one, I don't think, of course, the Ba'athists will come back ever. I think that's out of the question. But another form of politicians and another form of government is in the horizon and is pushing. But as far as the U.S. troops, I think the biggest question is the big picture, and that is today there is real tension between Iran and the U.S., and Iraq is the biggest playing field, I think, that will manifest that tension. Of course, Iran has a strategic interest, not only in Iraq, but now self-interest to defend itself, and it sees bugging down the U.S. in Iraq is something that will help its agenda. So I think there are real efforts to push towards to muddy the water in Iraq and making it far more difficult for the U.S. to be in Iraq. And I think this is going to drain a lot of U.S. resources.
That was Laith Kuba, Iraqi analyst in D.C. We also spoke with Gabriel Gatehouse, BBC correspondent in Baghdad.
The conversation continues at thetakeaway.org. Leave a comment now.
Let's check in now on stories we've been following at 15 minutes past the hour.
Back to that Chilean earthquake. The United Nations says it will rush aid deliveries to Chile after the government asked for help in the earthquake recovery effort. There are reports this morning that many hospitals in the worst affected areas have either collapsed or been badly damaged. But doctors are getting to many of the people who need help, according to Chilean civil servant Sebastian Peña.
There's a system in place to provide doctors to rural areas, so there are doctors there. But the supply lines of equipment and drugs are cut for the moment.
You can find out more, and especially how to donate to the Chilean relief effort, at thetakeaway.org. Back home, Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she is confident of getting the votes needed to pass the president's health care reform bill in the House. Speaking on ABC's This Week, Pelosi urged House Democrats to get behind the bill, even if it threatens their reelection chances.
Toyota President Akio Toyota has issued another apology. This time it was to Chinese customers. Toyota was speaking at a Beijing news conference. Americans are spending more than expected. Data released in the last hour shows personal spending is up 0.5% in January. Finally, 2009 was a beautiful year for Irish rock band U2. Billboard magazine is reporting the band raked in more money than any other music act in the U.S. last year. U2 made $109 million from touring, record sales, and royalties. That is almost twice as much as Bruce Springsteen, who came in second.
Let's look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, we talk more details and highlights about that game in the Winter Olympics with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Canada versus the U.S., in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning, everyone. We are certainly following the developing aftermath of the Chilean earthquake. The death toll now at 708. Very unpredictable, and we'll have more on that later on this hour. But we begin with Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. This week, a full plate for the Supreme Court, but three very interesting cases. Adam, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
You know, this is one of the best parts about your beat covering the Supreme Court. I mean, in a single week, you're going to have a case that refers to Enron and Jeffrey Skillings. The Second Amendment comes up in a case in Chicago, and an issue where people are suing to actually get damages from a Somali leader living here in the United States. Let's begin with the Skillings case.
So Jeff Skilling, convicted of fraud over the collapse of Enron, he was the former chief executive, and he's come to the court with two different issues, both of them pretty interesting. One is he says the law under which he was convicted is too vague, and it is a pretty ambiguous law. It says you can't deprive someone else of your honest services, whatever that means. And the second issue in the case, just as interesting, is whether he could receive a fair trial in Houston, where Enron was headquartered and which was devastated. And the amount of media publicity and community prejudice really was quite high. So the Supreme Court's going to look at a question and hasn't looked at it in a long time, which is when do you have to change venue if the community you're going to try somebody in is very hostile to that person?
Interesting. And any particular, I mean, is the change of venue the hotter issue than the vagueness of the law?
The vagueness of the law question is a very good question, but it's the third time this term the court has come at it. They're very interested in the law, and it's not clear that this is the main vehicle to figure that out, whereas the change of venue they haven't looked at really seriously since the 60s.
Wow.
So we could get an interesting decision on that.
So on Tuesday, tell us about this case, McDonald versus the City of Chicago.
This is the follow-on to the case 2 years ago, really landmark case, which holds the Second Amendment applicable to the federal government. So the federal government can't pass gun laws that violate your second for your individual rights to bear arms. So we know that now about the federal government, and that case came out of D.C., which is a federal enclave. The open question, and the one they're going to resolve in this new case on Tuesday, is does it also apply to state and local government action? The answer to that is probably yes. Most of the Bill of Rights have been held to apply to the states and to localities, but not all of them. And obviously it's a case with major, major consequences.
And the court is very sympathetic to the Second Amendment based on the records. Do you expect a split decision here or something more lopsided?
Well, they went 5-4 on the question of whether it applies to the federal government. So one good kind of bet is same people still on the
right.
Court. 5-4 is a likely outcome
here,
too. Looks
like a 5-4. The third case involves five Somalis who are suing their former prime minister who currently lives in the United States. First of all, what's the jurisdiction and what's the issue?
The question is, is a former head of state living here immune from suit? And lurking in the background is the question of, do we want other nations maybe going after our government officials for things that some people would say are not terribly dissimilar from what this Somali general was accused of?
And are they charging criminal or civilian?
No, they're looking for money damages.
Money damages. All right. Of the three cases, anyone likely landmark?
The Second Amendment case is an awfully important case.
All right, Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, taking a look at what the court will be hearing in arguments this week.
And what a game. Where were you yesterday afternoon? Where were you, John?
I was asleep, actually, yesterday.
Oh, well, yeah. Some of us who actually had our eyes open were sitting in, some of us, and, you know, tens of millions, I guess, watching what I would have to say was the Super Bowl of hockey, the last grander of the Olympics on its final day in Vancouver. I'm talking, of course, about yesterday's final matchup between the United States and Canada.
Back ahead now comes Sidney Crosby. Crosby tries to dance through. Miller guides it away to the corner. Crosby up with it there. Punched along to Jerome McGinley. Crosby scores! It's over! The gold medal to Canada!
Oh, sigh. Well, after tying the game with a breathtaking 24 seconds left in the third period, Team USA had to settle for silver. In that sudden death overtime you just heard, Team Canada won the men's gold medal hockey match 3-2. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports contributor, hi, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You were watching too, I know.
Yes, of course.
It was so exciting.
Listen, Team USA played in surges, and they played in these really big onslaughts, but they couldn't sustain them. And at the end, what they say is the cream rises to the top. The longer the game, the better the team is going to win. And the Canadian team is clearly the best team in the world, and this couldn't have been a more storybook ending. The best player on the best team, Sidney Crosby, on the best team in the world. And mind you, Sidney Crosby last year was the 22. He's 22 years old. He was the youngest captain ever to win as on a Stanley Cup for the Pittsburgh Penguins. So now, a year later, he wins a gold medal. What's he going to do next?
He was fabulous. But Parise, can we talk about that last-minute score in regular game by the U.S. team was pretty spectacular.
Parise, whose father's Canadian. So Parise playing, he grew up in the United States. His dad was a great hockey player for the Islanders.
It's all Canadian.
Well, they're all exactly. Canadian. It's absolutely true. Now, listen, not to take away from Canada, because I'm with you. Cream did rise to the top. They were not the young team that the U.S. team was.
Certainly.
And so, sure, they won. But Ryan Miller, the goalie for the U.S. team, was truly magnificent.
And his coach was actually – his coach on the Buffalo Sabres was a coach on the Team Canada. And they had a private moment right at the end of the game where he came up and he told them, you're still the best player in the world. You're still the best goalie. But it was still frustrating for Miller.
And the looks on their faces at the end during the medal ceremony told it all.
It was brutal.
Let us go just briefly to yet another sport, college basketball this weekend. A lot of upsets.
March 1st.
All weekend, the best teams were losing. And I just want to point
Except
out that my favorite team is the Syracuse.
Hey, John, you're muttering. What is this muttering?
The Syracuse Orange are still they still won this weekend. They beat Villanova. But the question isn't who's going to win. The question is who's built to beat Syracuse. And that's the question. They may not be number one in the country, but who has the best team structured to beat them? And as we head into the March Madness season, it's going to get real exciting in college basketball.
And Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, you'll be here to tell us all about it. John?
Yes, indeed. Taking us through the March Madness. Coming up, preparing for earthquakes. It's something deep in the fabric of Chilean culture and history. We'll explore that in just a few moments. But right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. What some in Congress are calling the so-called nuclear option may be on the horizon for the health care reform bill. The White House is calling for a simple up or down vote, which means bypassing minority Republicans in the Senate in a process called reconciliations. There are reports President Obama may officially endorse reconciliation in the next few days. We're learning this morning about the president's nuclear weapons strategy. The New York Times is reporting the plan includes permanently reducing America's nuclear arsenal by thousands of weapons, as well as narrowing the circumstances under which the U.S. would use those weapons.
Also this morning, President Obama is offering $900 million in grants to states and school districts to turn around low-performing schools. The Winter Olympics in Vancouver may have ended last night, but Russia is already looking ahead to 4 years from now. President Dmitry Medvedev is calling for officials in charge of preparing Russian athletes for the Winter Games to resign after the country, suffered its worst ever performance in Vancouver. Russia came in 11th in the medal tally, 3 golds, 15 medals. And what was the top movie at the box office this weekend?
These are all violent offenders, right? I mean, they've hurt people, murdered them in some cases.
In almost all cases, yes.
And personally, Doctor, I'd have to say screw their sense of calm.
Yeah, well, if you were watching the Olympics, you probably saw the commercials. For the second straight week, it was Martin Scorsese's thriller, Shutter Island, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Ben Kingsley. Took in $22 million, is on pace to be the director's top earner ever. Meanwhile, Avatar crossed the $700 million domestic mark.
Yeah, there's a flop.
Yeah, the first movie ever to do so, Kel Surprise. Some reports have director James Cameron's personal cut from the earnings at a cool, ready for this, John? $225 million.
Oh, he doesn't need an avatar. He'd just rather be James Cameron, you know?
That's what happens when you have blue skin. You get that kind of money.
Wall Street is open. The Dow is up about 50 points right at the open. The NASDAQ up about 13.5, and the S&P up about 7 points. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning. So it was the largest earthquake in recorded history, one of the largest anyway, one of the deadliest earthquakes in Chile since the Valdivia earthquake of 1960. Over the weekend, an 8.8 tremor hit the country of Chile on the Pacific Rim, sending tsunami warnings west across the Pacific. The death toll in Chile has risen above 700 victims, and the question now is what will unfold in the next few days. Joining us now is Charlotte Mountford, a writer in Santiago, Chile, and also with us is John Dingus, a journalist here in New York who created Archivos Chile, an investigative journalist archive who has long history in the country. He joins us from Washington. John, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, John?
Fine. Charlotte Mountford, let me begin with you. You felt what this was like, 500 times more powerful than the Haitian earthquake. How long did the ground shake?
Well, it felt like absolutely forever, but I'm told it was 40 seconds. My boyfriend and I cowered in our bathtub while the room, we were up on the 14th floor of our apartment building, and the whole apartment was just lurching. it wasn't shaking, it was lurching from side to side. I can't describe it, the fear. I was in absolute terror. Things were crashing around, all around us, and yet the earthquake itself was silent, and that was what was so eerie. I expected a roar, I expected a rumble. It was just silent, rocking earth.
Oh, that is quite a vivid sort of set of images there. Charlotte, as you went around and talked to people in Santiago over the next several hours and really through the weekend, where is that fear today? The aftershocks have been continuing. Are people still afraid?
Yeah, people are still afraid. The aftershocks are horrible reminders of what has happened. It's like kind of pressure on an open wound every time they occur. It's just our nerves are shot to pieces. We haven't had much sleep because they're going on through the night. And when you're lying in bed and you feel the bed shake again, you think, oh no, is this the last straw? Is the building actually going to come tumbling down after all? But of course, lots of our panic is now directed down to the south and to the coast, where we don't know what has happened to people. Many people are still waiting for news of their families.
Right, and Concepcion, of course, the southern city, which is the closest to the epicenter, and communications apparently off still to this hour in Concepcion.
No, they've actually recovered quite a lot of the communications Concepcion.
That's great. We were talking.
It's now coastal towns that are really kind of the ones that people are trying to reach.
Well, that's good to hear.
They're really in the dark.
Let me bring John Dingus in here. There are raw nerves from the long history of earthquakes in Chile among Chileans, but there's also a lot of fears regarding political stability in the country. Is that likely to be tested over the next few days?
Well, actually, Chile is one of the most stable countries in Latin America, one of the best organized, has the least corrupt government. And so if any government in Latin America was equipped to handle a tragedy like this, you would have to say that Chile is definitely at the top of the list.
And it's really a testimony to how much has changed in a generation in Chile.
Well, this is a country that underwent 17 years of military dictatorship. And during that period, infrastructure was neglected. Roads, bridges, things like that were not built, even though the economy was fairly strong. Now, since 1990, when the present democratic government came in and was led by a center-left coalition, they have basically made an enormous effort to build up the infrastructure. It's also a country with very strict building codes that are actually enforced. This is, unusual in most countries in Latin America.
Well, let's talk about that, because we've seen in the boom and bust periods in a lot of cities in this hemisphere that the codes kind of go out the window when there's a period of surplus, but that's absolutely not the case in Chile.
As far as I can tell, for example, Santiago, when I lived there in the 70s, it was very rare to see a building over 10 stories. Now you see buildings that are over 20 stories routinely. All of that new construction, enormous construction boom in the 1990s, none of those buildings were seriously affected, as far as I can tell. The major damage is in the south, and actually, what we're finding out is that it was the tidal wave, the local tsunami, that has done the most damage and has caused the most deaths.
Interesting. And, of course, as time goes on, the initial reports are changed by the reality on the ground. Charlotte Mountford, is that what people are saying there in Santiago, that it is the tsunami that really is the culprit in most of the damage?
Well, ONEMI, which is the emergency office, have been saying that they suspect many more bodies are, in fact, underneath the water and have not been found yet. And there have been reports of cars having been sucked out to sea. And, so, yes, definitely.
And boats deposited in the middle of city squares. And is that true in cities all from north to south on the coast?
Yeah, I think all up and down the coast there's big destruction, big devastation.
We talked earlier with the U.S. ambassador, who was concerned about the rather large American presence. Is there a large American community there, Charlotte?
In Concepcion?
As far as I know, less than in Santiago, I would say not that much. I'd say the real risk is foreign people, Brits and American citizens being on the coast in the tourist regions. And the worry is that they didn't know to run to the hills like the local people did.
Charlotte Mountford, a writer in Santiago, giving us a first-hand look at what's going on in Chile since the earthquake on Saturday. And John Dingus, a journalist who created Archivos Chile, an investigative journalist archive. John Dingus has plenty of experience and knowledge of the history and politics of Chile. He joined us from Washington. You can find out how to donate to the relief effort at our site, thetakeaway.org. And the tragedy in Chile might have you thinking about, what if a disaster struck you or your neighbors or your community? We want to check how these recent natural disasters have put things into perspective. What are your thoughts? What you take away is most important to your life. Tell us at 877-8MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, look at The Tonight Show once again. It's Leno's first day back, but what should we watch for? Will Conan O'Brien's writers be watching? We'll find out. So 200 years ago, Europe had made it through the horrors of the French Revolution and was ending Napoleon's dreams of global domination. And Europe was beginning to feel the pull of new lands to the west, lands that had thrown off the old rules in Europe of politics and art. And into this storm of change was born Frédéric Chopin, at once a musician of Poland, but with a universal voice of this new age of romanticism, born 200 years ago today. Terrence McKnight, evening music host for WQXR Classical Radio in New York, is here with a tribute. Terrence, good morning.
I thought I'd sing you into the segment, John.
Well, that's great. Why is Chopin's music so hummable? And you're humming the famous Funeral March there.
Yeah, that Funeral March is very famous. It's been famous for since he wrote it. And I think his music is so popular and still is, you know, so prevalent now in concert halls and recordings because it's hummable. It's singable. And that's what he aspired to do. He wrote in these small forms, and he wrote music that was very intimate, very personal, and very romantic. And I think, you know, it's music of our time for those reasons. Very personal, very romantic, and just a very beautiful singing voice.
They don't let you hum Chopin on WQXR, right? That's why we're going to play some for real here. So this is the singing Chopin, right?
Typically with Chopin's music, you get that right hand that's going to have a melody much like a singer, and that's what he was attempting to do. Chopin loved opera, and he was the pianist who wanted to get the instrument to sound like a singer. And so you get this accompaniment happening in the left hand with this beautiful singing line on top.
Is that why Chopin is regarded as a Polish musician, a nationalist, but also a universal sort of creator of melodies?
Well, the thing about the nationalism is, you know, when Chopin wrote, nationalism was sweeping across Europe, and Chopin had gone on tour. He was half Polish, half French. He had gone on tour, and while he was on tour, he learned that his hometown had been taken over by the Russians, so he couldn't go back home, so he spent the rest of his life in France, and so he took his Polish music with him. So as he moved to France, he wanted to represent the music of Poland. And so you hear these forms and these dances and melodies and rhythms that are Polish. And so therefore he became known as a composer of Polish nationalism.
But he's universal. I mean, a lot of pop musicians have gotten a piece of Chopin down through the ages. I'm Always Chasing Rainbows is a Chopin knockoff. The Perry Como hit Till the End of Time. And then there's this one, Barry Manilow. You know this one? Recognize that?
I do. And John, you know, I was listening to, I was watching the NBA All-Star game a couple of weeks ago, and I heard an Alicia Keys song, and the beginning of her song sounds so much like Chopin. It evokes the same atmosphere. So I think, you know, people like Barry Manilow, Jacques Lussier, Alicia Keys, they're still invoking the sound of his music in creating their own music, and sometimes by reinterpreting his music from 170 years ago.
Well, there will be a 171-hour concert in Warsaw in tribute to the 200th birthday of Chopin. Take us out, Terrence.
We're going to go out listening to Chopin. Was, you know, one of strength, too. His music had a lot of strength. And I think we'll go out listening to perhaps some of his revolutionary etudes.
Terrence McKnight, evening music host for WQXR.
I'm Lynn Scherr, while Celeste Headlee is out for one more day. And coming up, it's the first day of The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Again, We find out what a former Conan writer thinks in a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour.
The United Nations says it will rush aid to Chile after the government asked for help in the aftermath of the Saturday earthquake. Ben Canozca is an American living in Santiago who tells CBS News that most of the cleanup effort so far has been focused on Santiago.
The key story this morning is that while Santiago might be back to relative normalcy down in Concepcion, it's still a lot of chaos.
Concepcion is the largest population center closest to the epicenter. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will be in Chile tomorrow morning. She's on a wider tour of Latin America, and you can find out how to donate to the Chile relief effort at thetakeaway.org.
Marines in the Afghan city of Marja say the Taliban is no longer in control, but insurgents are now striking supply convoys with roadside bombs. NATO Lance Corporal John Kane says it's difficult to know which side the local people are on.
Going through all the houses, everyone acts the same. You know, they can't find anything. You know they're up to no good, some of them. And you just can't find anything.
Moving to North Africa, Al-Qaeda's terror network is growing more active and attracting new recruits. That according to U.S. Defense and counterterrorism officials. And they say it's threatening to further destabilize the continent's already vulnerable Sahara region. To tell us more, we're joined by the BBC's Africa editor, Martin Plaut, who joins us from Bush House in London. Martin, good morning to you. What are the signs that Al-Qaeda is increasing its influence in North Africa?
Well, there have been a number of signs for a long time, in fact, that Al-Qaeda sort of waxes and wanes. It's difficult to tell exactly where they are. I mean, you need a briefing from the security people to get this. But the way to look at the Sahara is as a huge sea that goes all the way from Mauritania right through to Chad, from Algeria in the north down to Nigeria in the south. And frankly, the Al-Qaeda groups see this just like the trade routes of old, a place to go, a place to hide, and a place to strike from when they can.
And there are signs of stepped up activity at the moment?
There have been some, but, you know, let me give you one example. Last year, there was a group called Boko Haram that was operating in the far north of Nigeria. That was broken up. Hundreds of people were left dead by the security forces. But, you know, where have the pieces gone? Where have the people gone? The young men who are dissatisfied with their lot, they are joining these kind of groups, and that is the problem. Now, the U.S. Africa Command sees this as one of their major targets. They work very closely with the governments of North Africa right across the Sahara, and they try to block it. But it's a very difficult thing. We've just had a coup in Chad. How is that going to affect this kind of operation? I don't know, but clearly it makes it more difficult when you've got to deal with a new government.
BBC's Africa editor Martin Plaut joining us from Bush House in London. John?
In conclusion, the Olympics are over. The 2010 Olympics ended with a glittering final ceremony. The medal count, well, the U.S. had the largest number of medals, 37 in all. Germany was second with 30, and the hosts, Canada, had 26. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. So if any of you out there were watching the Olympics the last 2 weeks, it might have seemed to you that Jay Leno was one of the competing athletes.
The stars who've thrilled us in Vancouver will be taking their victory lap with Jay. Lindsey Vonn
is the gold medalist.
Shaun White,
double gold.
And Apollo Ohno,
he is the Olympic champion,
are all on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, starting this Monday on NBC.
That's right. That's tonight. If bombing in primetime was Leno's freestyle event, he's back to the grand slalom. Jay Leno is the new old host of The Tonight Show, starting tonight. And if there's a lesson to all the Leno, Conan O'Brien, Sturm and Drang we were reporting about a few weeks back when it was all up in the air, it's just how fragile this late-night comedy relationship is between viewers and hosts. And I'm kind of wondering, Rob Kuttner, former writer for The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien, are you going to be watching Leno tonight?
I have to be honest, this is a big debate in my family. I mean, we're not a Nielsen family, so it doesn't matter, but I think we decided in the end that we couldn't watch the whole show. We decided we're going to probably, like, watch the clips on Gawker tomorrow with some sufficiently snarky commentary. It's like watching a baseball game in a sports bar with your fans and watching the rival team together.
Conan, I gather, is in the middle of a pretty big drinking binge, if we can judge by this comment on January 19th.
Hello there, I am Conan O'Brien, and I am just 3 days away from the biggest drinking binge in history.
Love Conan O'Brien. How would you describe the difference between Conan's humor, Conan's relationship with his audience, and Jay Leno's?
Well, I think we found it out pretty strongly during this whole kerfuffle the past few weeks. I mean, I think Conan always knew that he had sort of an enthusiastic following, but we had out to Universal Studios with these "I'm with Coco" signs, and he, of course, he saw. It doesn't take much to be an activist on Facebook, but I mean, getting, I think, half a million people, and that, there was definitely some kind of outpouring that we were not even familiar with before. But it was pretty exciting.
I mean, I was thinking about this morning, and it seemed to me that, you know, maybe the Tonight Show was always kind of a bad fit for Conan on some level, GE and NBC being so corporate, and that the chance on Fox, or the chance, you know, in a fresh location to find that audience and to make it a totally Conan thing is maybe a good thing.
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking about whether if he had a better lead in at 10 o'clock, you know, he would have been better, or if he had more chance to grow into the slot. But yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. I think Conan is, from what I've seen, is definitely was disappointed and a little bit crushed by not getting that James spot for longer. But I think he's also a guy who's very open to, you know, new frontiers, as it were.
And, you know, I mean, he even reminded us just how close to his heart the whole NBC family. And I used to work over there. That's what they talk about, NBC family. Listen to this.
I've worked with NBC for over 20 years. Yes, we have our differences right now. Yes, we're going our separate ways. But this company has been my home for most of my adult life. I am enormously proud of the work we've done together, and I want to thank NBC for making it all possible. I really do.
I mean, is this the story of corporate big brother Jay Leno winning out over the little brother, and he basically is homeless now?
A little bit, yeah. I would say he probably regards him less, NBC less as family than more as, like, let's say, in-laws right now.
Yeah.
Or maybe even, like, exes, you know.
So yeah.
But it's NBC to party and say, oh, you're looking well. He, Conan at one point characterized this as he feels like he went off to college, or his big brother went off to college and then didn't do so well and came back and then demanded his room back.
Well, and burnt the house down, too. I mean,
I guess so.
It took all the toys.
Yeah.
I mean, you could really go.
Paper over the wallpaper.
Well, how much of this is material for the new Conan venture, depending on how and where it comes from, goes?
Well, that actually might technically be a question for the lawyers in terms of what
right.
he actually can and can't say.
Yeah.
But I imagine if he starts something new, he won't want to dwell too much on it because it's the past. But boy, did we have fun dwelling on that for the 2 weeks that
yeah.
was happening.
And it's all on the record. Let me ask you one last question about this comment Conan made on the 22nd of January.
So to all the people watching, I can never, ever thank you enough for the kindness to me. I'll think about it for the rest of my life. And all I ask is one thing, and I'm asking this particularly of young people that watch. Please do not be cynical. I hate cynicism. For the record, it's my least favorite quality. It doesn't lead anywhere. Nobody in life gets exactly what they thought they were going to get. But if you work really hard and you're kind, amazing things will happen. I'm telling you, amazing things will happen. I'm telling you.
So, Rob Cuttner, did Conan Yoda surprise you there in that moment?
A little bit. Well, not only for his correct use of grammar and syntax, but yeah, I think it was a surprise. I mean, a lot of what he did was he really thought hard. Even his decision about before he launched that New York Times op-ed, a lot of it took us sort of by surprise. But like, one of the things where as soon as it happens, you're like, oh yeah, of course. Of course that's what he's going to do, because that's who he is. I mean, we thought when he took that opportunity, he had one more chance to take a shot, and we thought maybe he was going to do some kind of, you know, sort of memorable manifesto of anger or disappointment. But, you know, when he kind of did a jujitsu where he turned it into an opportunity to impart a message that was more profound, I think it was a surprise, and then a minute later it was exactly the Conan that we knew. That was who he was.
Rob Cuttner, former writer for The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien, as well as The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and Dennis Miller Live, who will sort of be watching Jay Leno's return to The Tonight Show tonight. Thanks, Rob.
And for you late night owls, we want to know from you, who's your preferred host for The Tonight Show, Jay or Conan, or does it matter? And if you happen to catch tonight's show and want to give us a review, keep this number on hand. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also go to our site where we have a special contest going on. Those of you cat lovers who were jealous about our dog pageant after the Westminster Dog Show, well, now there's one for cats. Send in your photos and we'll let you vote on the Takeaway's Best in Cat Show starting on Wednesday. Find out more on our website, thetakeaway.org, or post the photo to our Facebook page, facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Best in cat, best in fur.
Waiting for your picture, John.
Oh, my God. Long time wait. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Sharon for Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.